You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 39 for June 2016. It is, in fact, June 30th, the last day of the month, but because people have lives and it's a busy summer, we had a delay from our usual Sunday recording time, and we're recording on a wonderful day here in western Pennsylvania. The weather is about 80 degrees, humidity is about 10%, and it is an outstanding evening here in southwestern Pennsylvania.
And so we're spending it sitting in John's basement recording a podcast.
We are part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Don't forget to visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and the show notes that we discuss from the stories today. And I want to thank everyone for their comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, and even some emails. I actually have a really cool tweet that I will talk about towards the end of the news that we received from Egypt. I am your host, John Costage. As I said, we're in southwestern Pennsylvania, and joining me today across the bar is...
I'm Harold.
He's also from western Pennsylvania. And joining us via Skype today, we'll start left to right, although no one else can see it but Harold and I. We'll start with Dave.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
And next is Jeff, who's also our guest today from the wonderful island of Vinyl Haven. I'm wondering if there's a delay getting to...
Hi, everybody.
I think there is a delay.
I think there'll be a little delay in talking to Jeff. That's okay.
Jeff's in a different time zone on Vinyl Haven. They're about 10 seconds behind the rest of us.
And I think he's in the Green Mountain State. Morgan?
That is the case. Hello, everyone. And we've got some beautiful weather up here, and I am very fortunate to live about a mile and a half from Lake Champlain, which is absolutely gorgeous this time of year.
Indeed. Yeah, they can follow you on Instagram, right? And you can get some cool shots that you show.
Totally.
Which is, you wish to share your Instagram account?
It is Line Trace.
There you go. Look them up on Line Trace. All right, let's talk about the news first. We will begin with an interesting article from Forbes, and it's entitled Record Jag Land Rover Sales, but Airbag Recall Cuts into Profits. The JLR's fiscal year ended in March 31. And just some.
So they start their fiscal year on April Fool's Day?
Well said, sir. I mean, I'm glad you saved that one for the podcast. That was good. interesting things to look at in the numbers, I think, when you look at all their different segments, their different markets. JLR sales in North America, they had 99,600 cars sold, which was a substantial increase of 27% from the previous year. Land Rover in particular was up 35%. Jag was down less than 2% in North America. European sales, not counting the UK or Russia, were up 42%. UK sales were up 24%. China was down 16%, despite a 19% improvement in the fiscal fourth quarter. Overall, China accounted for 19% of JLR sales worldwide, which was down 25% from the previous year. North America accounted for 19%, which was up from 17% the previous year. And here you go. Here's a cool stat. Worldwide revenue for JLR was equivalent of about $32.5 billion.
Almost enough to pay for two Volkswagen scandals.
Yes.
I was going to say, I think our marketing people need to take a look at these press releases, because I definitely wouldn't have said anything about the airbags and losses related to them. I might have mentioned it in passing, but said... On a lighter note.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to lead with that.
No. Well, but don't forget, this is Forbes, so they took that information and they can spin it.
I thought it was interesting that their European numbers are already not including the UK.
Well, this is before that, but yeah.
I understand that. I understand. Foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing, yes, indeed.
They've been doing that a long time, but very foreshadowing.
So that
I think the whole of the UK sort of treats it that way anyway.
Hence the reason for the vote in the first place.
Yep.
new vehicle segment. The Disco 5 has been spotted, thanks to Land Rover Owner International, and this it's even less less disguised than usual.
Yeah, less than usual. It never really was ever. So,
well, what do you think? What do you think of this design lines? Because usually you like all those. I don't particularly like this one, but. Yeah, what do you think of that?
It's I like the other ones better, but this one's kind of interesting too.
You can now see more of the vehicle itself.
I like that they're creative with their urban camo as opposed to a lot of companies that are just pretty plain about it.
Yeah, and they put those swirls. So this is the Disco 5, and it will look a lot like the Disco Sport. It's going to look a lot like the Range Rover, and there you go. No Alpine windows.
Thanks,
none.
Jerry. Thanks a lot, Jerry.
Yeah, none. It's just they're all to me. They're all going to look alike.
Can we start calling him the Butcher of Birmingham?
We may have a show title, "The Butcher of Birmingham." It's Birmingham, by the way. If you need to watch Peaky Blinders, you'll learn it's you say it Birmingham. Interesting things to pull out from reading this LRO article was the Land Rover's engineers are making a concerted effort to overcome the outgoing Disco 4's main weakness, its 2.5-ton curb weight, which ironically is also one of its greatest assets, making the current model a phenomenal tow car. And the current steel T5 chassis will be ditched in favor of a new aluminum monocoque frame.
That should be delightful when it starts bouncing off rocks.
Well...
Yeah,
I think that, I guess they're not going to encourage people to do that as much, or want them to do it as much as they used to. I mean, that's at least for this family, that's what the Defender family would be.
I'd like to suggest that we might be underestimating the tensile strength of the aluminum-based unibody. There is nothing that says it should be any weaker than bouncing off rocks. I know they're doing this.
Well, tensile strength is one thing. Impact resistance is another, Jeff.
Agreed. But
for a while.
But I don't know that it's necessarily going to cause it to be any less. This isn't the pickup bed of a Ford. It's the unibody underneath the car or of the car.
I think all the do the residents of Vinyl Haven double in the summer? I think they're taking all the bandwidth, Jeff.
We do double up. Unfortunately, I'm not on a very robust internet connection anyway, but this is not a problem we've had in the past.
Yeah, it's some reason it's
true.
I know.
Well, turn the crank a little faster or something.
We'll try to muddle through. So that's a Disco 5. I think from what we picked up from Jeff's comments was, so Harold was saying tensile strength and impact, and I think Jeff was indicating that maybe it's better than we think it is.
Jeff thinks we should rely on the engineers to tell us it's okay.
You know, I'm sure it's strong enough. There are a lot of vehicles that have switched to aluminum unibodies, and they have very good methods of extruding them and bending them so that they're nice and strong. My concern would be, what does this do to, you know, the overall, you know, center of gravity and such? You know, one of the benefits of having a body on frame is that a lot of your unsprung weight is lower than the rest of the body, especially on Land Rovers where they're using aluminum bodies for the most part.
Actually, the frame is entirely sprung weight, Morgan.
Sorry. That's what I mean, is that the sprung weight is much lower.
I'm just the other thing I'm looking at is that maybe it's as strong now, but 10 years from now, what's the difference going to be?
Right,
that's the problem with aluminum.
Yeah, it definitely has problems with work hardening and weakening.
And when you're relying on the sheet metal to provide your rigidity, the first time you put a dent in it, that's compromised.
Yep, and it's. It's kind of surprising. Well, I mean, it's not entirely surprising that Land Rover is going this direction because, as we said, it is reducing body weight significantly.
Well, production cost and everything else is a lot less when you go uni, but you know, because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean you should.
Right, and it does make it become much more of a throwaway vehicle, and you know, it's surprising some of the competition is I wouldn't say it's actually competition, but they're finally catching up to Land Rover's age-old method of doing, you know,
body on frame with a nice strong box frame and aluminum bodies and stuff like that. Like even Ford is doing that now. It's a little too bad to see companies like Ford finally doing that and Land Rover getting out of that and making more throwaway vehicles.
Well, Land Rover's decided to make cars instead of trucks.
True.
I would like to suggest that Land Rover does have to actually sell new vehicles in a market with regulations around fuel economy, and those regulations, those strident regulations, are extremely difficult to meet with a heavier vehicle. I'm not certain that just because they are more car-like in feel, they are any less Land Rover. That being said, I would not Series 2A. If I had a Range Rover Classic, I would not give it up. If I had a Discovery 1, I would not give it up for a new Land Rover product. I wouldn't trade them even up. We have to understand that Land Rover's requirements for worldwide sales anywhere include both fuel economy and emission standards, and lightweight, for better or for worse, is a part of the equation, a critical part of the equation right now. In fact, you may have all seen the automotive news feature that notes we will likely see entirely new electrical systems in all vehicles, 48 volts instead of 12 volts, within the relatively near future because of the electrical demands on all vehicles.
Yeah, you could save a couple hundred pounds in copper just by doubling and tripling the voltage.
You can all, and we know that features that I don't particularly like as an enthusiast, but are routine now, are everything electric power steering pumps to electric water pumps. And the more electrical motors that appear in these vehicles, the greater the demands for higher voltage. But at the same time, the less weight. And again, it's a move away from something that I prefer. But then I probably don't prefer a brand new vehicle.
Have you seen the recent Top Gears, the British ones? They kind of covered some of this with they had the new Rolls-Royce Dawn versus like the old Rolls-Royce Dawn. That was kind of an interesting one they discussed about old versus new. And you know, if you want a new, you know, the new stuff drives nicely, but you know, it doesn't have the patina and doesn't have the lived-in feel. Again, it's what you want.
And it's something we're seeing across all industries, really. So,
yeah. Well, you know, if I can add to some of this in kind of a tangential way, personal individual cars, I think, is something that may end in the some point in the future. It may not be 10 or 20 years, but I think it's coming where, you know, they're going to become a commodity and you're going to be able to summon a vehicle. It'll come. You don't want to say own one. You may, and you'll say, I need a car and I need it at 6 a.m. in the morning and go to work, and it'll come. Car will pick up and you won't care what it looks like. It's just going to be a, you know, conveyance at that point. And I don't know. I think that they all start to look alike. And I think there is more and more of that commonality for the reasons that Jeff mentioned, but also I think because, you know, it's becoming this kind of commodity.
There is a dark side to the future.
There is. A little interesting note along that too. You know, Uber here has an institute here in Pittsburgh. They teamed up with Carnegie Mellon, and they are looking into making cars that drive themselves. And I guess the point of that is they'll eventually get rid of the drivers, and they won't need to have drivers anymore for the Uber. I also think, because from what we can tell, I think they're down here at the old VW plant, not far from my house. I think they're test driving cars down there because there's a sample road and you can see lights and they got the boxes out so they can drive around it. So they got security there too. But we think Uber's down there, so it's stuff's coming. I guess it's off the topic of the new Disco 5, but there you go. So there's a 2018 Range Rover Sport Coupe has been spied in Scotland, and this may or may not be the name, but it's going to be slotted between the Range Rover Evoque and the Range Rover Sport. And this is, they don't know what the name is going to be exactly yet, but it's going to be somewhere between those two. And
what about the Super Sport?
The Range Rover Super Sport? It could be.
Super Sport Supercharged?
And I guess it's supposed to compete with the Mercedes GLE and the BMW X6 in kind of in that area, and it's probably going to be based off of the Jag F-Pace platform, and it should have a V6 and a V8 engine in it, possibly even hybrids, maybe even a full electric version at some point. But there you go. So there's another in the Range Rover family coming.
I like the notion because the first Range Rover was a two-door, so it's kind of nice coming full circle.
Right, but it'll be more sloped in the back. The boot area will be smaller, and you know.
Well, it's a small Range Rover. It just is.
It'll be a bigger Evoque.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, just one more way for the Americans to get confused as to what is it a Range Rover? Is it a Land Rover?
How's that Land Rover of yours? Mm-hmm. Or how's that Range Rover of yours?
Yeah, your Range Rover 109 that's sitting out there, for instance.
That's right. That's right. Any comment?
I'd rather have them call it a Range Rover than a Jeep.
Or a Hummer. I've had my meat wagon referred to as a Hummer once.
Well, it's an interesting marketing challenge for Land Rover. In many parts of the world, the Land Rover brand is firmly cemented, whereas the Range Rover is quite rare. It's the U.S. market that flips it on its heels. In the U.S., the Range Rover Sport is the largest selling model of any Land Rover here, and followed by the Evoque, the full-size Range Rover, LR4 Disco Sport. The dilemma is, I think, coming more out of the dealer network, who are saying, we have customers who bought a Range Rover Sport. They love its feel and or power. I have nothing to offer them for their next vehicle or for another vehicle. Can we slot something in that allows them to stay within the Range Rover Sport family? And this is what it allows them to do.
So for the well-heeled Range Rover family, this is sort of their second vehicle.
Well, it is very interesting you'd use that phrasing because apparently, and it's these aren't people that I necessarily know, but many, many Range Rover owners have multiple Range Rovers.
Yeah, and I think that goes to the point where they'll have a Range Rover, and then they used to buy an LR2 or a Freelander for their kid going off to college. Now they can buy them an Evoque.
Or I'm thinking they've got the one for the family, and then they've got the little one that just commutes back and forth to the train station.
True.
Yeah, I think it would be really smart if they would put the Ingenium diesel turbocharged in there.
I suspect that's probably on the list, but that doesn't say that in this article. But
no, it may be that for the Range Rover Sport, for the U.S. market, there's no particular either need or demand for, if you will, a fuel-efficient, high-speed Range Rover. But the diesel sales, which were at first thought about in terms of maybe 5% of Range Rover orders, with the initial surge, rose up to 15%. So it may be that it turns out that it's a more popular set of options than they initially thought.
You didn't know this, but this leads us into our next topic, which is JLR UK boss says that diesels will continue to dominate, and despite the air pollution concerns, it still accounts for 70% of UK sales annually. So apparently, they think diesels are to stay, even though VW has its problems and has. I don't know, it hasn't really affected the U.S. sales.
Volkswagen's problems are not directly related to weaknesses in the technology. Their problems are an entirely different animal.
Right. And I also think the impact here in the U.S. is a lot less, too, just because
it's more of a public relations nightmare than anything else.
And the number of diesels here in the U.S. is significantly small.
But not for Volkswagen.
True.
It was a significant technological halo for Volkswagen. It's been that way for a while. So their hit was the whole idea that there was something special about their German engineering.
Right, and when it turns out the something special was that they cheated,
then they turned off the controls.
Took the wind out of that.
Indeed.
Right. And
it gets reduced
and apparently
to being,
within Europe itself too.
Yeah, it reduces the technology to being as good as everybody else's, but nothing special.
Exactly, and they didn't have much that was special.
And really, they were one of certainly for consumer passenger vehicles, they were the only somewhat affordable option for diesels in the U.S. for a very long time.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, and their old ones, the ones from the 90s, if you will, were legendary. I mean, people get vast mileage from them.
Yep.
Yep.
And I got to say, the new one, the Common Rail, is really a sweet engine mechanically. It's a great engine. It's just they got caught up in some bad juju with their emissions control, but it doesn't make it any less of a good engine.
Well, hopefully that, as we've talked before, and apparently according to this article, that doesn't negatively impact the diesels here for Land Rover anyways. Because, I mean, I know they've come up with a couple models, although I don't think the Disco Sport is going to have a diesel here in the U.S., which is unfortunate.
John, I think it will.
Okay.
And I think it will be that 2-liter Ingenium engine that it's scheduled to come into full use for Land Rover. So I think we will see one here because, again, I think the pressure to get to that 54 miles per gallon over time is going to make it at least be available. And the more that they can push on people, the more they can sell, the better their fuel economy averages will be.
True.
And to your earlier point that, maybe in the U.S. for Range Rover, the target market, fuel economy may not be an important factor. But I think that now that people are starting to get used to the idea of diesel here, they're seeing more diesel stations around for consumer vehicles, that the convenience factor of not having to fill up as frequently
I think
will help.
Once you get a good experience base going and people tell their friends and they're getting this mileage or that mileage and the fact that their engine's lasting 400,000 miles, there's a lot of things that the experience has to play out. But once word gets out, I think there'll be demand.
Well, and also the sound is not as bad as it used to be. They had a loud, clattery sound. They don't have that anymore.
Some of us like that, but I can see why if some people don't. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's not your grandfather's diesel anymore.
Or Oldsmobile,
yeah.
Well, I think it's
My Ram, if you think that it doesn't make that noise anymore.
Well, your Ram is a beast.
As it should be.
And I think part of this is, to try to correlate this to other industries, a lot of it is just the way technology moves forward, that initially, there's technologies that enthusiasts like those of us who are really into diesels know to be better and more practical, but it takes a while for them to filter out to the masses before they find that they're as convenient. I mean, even like cell phones are a pretty good example that originally there were people running around who found it worth paying money for cell phones, and now everybody has a cell phone in their pocket, and it's just a convenience factor, and it's normal.
Right. Well, I want to see the Disco Sport come in within time for me to use my Jetta rebate money, maybe as a down payment.
I thought that would help.
Awesome. Now following that, the 110 upgrade money.
I was going to say, I thought that was paying for the restoration of the 110.
If I had to turn the only reason I would turn in my Jetta TDI for, I think would be a diesel Land Rover, preferably the Disco Sport, because that's
good choice.
I think that would be about the only thing I would otherwise, because see, my dilemma is that the the Jetta is going to be paid off come next April, and you know, a paid off car is fantastic to have. And you know,
but on the other hand, when you sell a paid off car, all that money goes in your pocket.
Right, but it's not going to sell for as much as it would if I don't sell it back to Volkswagen, because they're going to pay you the what it should have been. But anyways, it's you know, I would, but the
tough
the,
choice for all of us owning Volkswagens at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's actually in some ways it's a good choice too.
Well, it's good to have the options, but everybody's got to make the choice based on their own situation.
Right.
Let's face it, the Disco Sport with the diesel would be much more comfortable for your planned excursion.
No, it's not. No. I'm taking a 110. The 110 is the okay. Excursion. No.
If the Disco Sport diesel is up to it, you can tow the 110 behind it.
Or the other way around.
What about a train? Can I tow a train? Oh, yes, I can. There's a video for that. Let's move on, shall we?
Nice
to
segue, John.
Thank you. The Jag J-Pace, and the reason I mention this is because it's going to be a bigger than the F-Pace, and it's supposed to have a diesel hybrid power, and we believe it'll be it will share a frame potentially with the Range Rover Sport Coupe
or the lack thereof.
So, so there's a bigger F-Pace coming. To compete with,
because that's what Jaguar needs, more trucks.
But you said that, but Land Rover's not building trucks, but yet this is looks like a truck, and so it's not a truck. Yeah,
I know. Yeah, I like.
You know, guys, we have to remember that 80% of Porsche sales are the Pan America, the Macan, the Cayenne. Only 20%. What we identify as enthusiasts as Porsches.
And those are products that Porsche has no business building.
Yeah, but you need that.
Perhaps,
need to make
but
money.
If it didn't build them, it claims, it would not have the funding to do anything else. They would have been absorbed by now.
So let's hope that the new Defender is what we actually want, and that all this, the rest of this stuff is going to fund the new Defender.
We pray, we are on our knees every night and every Sunday for just that.
All right.
Now that, I think we all can agree with Jeff on that one.
All right. We could end on that note almost.
That's it. The podcast's over. Okay, we're done.
And on that bombshell.
No, we don't do that anymore. Moving on.
We do, actually, as a setup to the fact that we announce we don't do it anymore.
That's right. You're right. Diesels more polluting below 18 degrees centigrade, research suggests. I think it's a little as a counterpoint to some of the diesel discussions we've just had. Apparently, there's a significant rise in poisonous gas emissions from a wide range of models as the temperature drops.
Well, yeah, the diesel requires temperature to ignite the fuel. So if the ambient temperature is lower, it's going to have a harder time being efficient about that process. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they do.
Does that extend to other types too? I guess gasoline, would that same thing happen?
Well, gasoline maybe not as much because there's a spark in the process, but gasoline engines are far less efficient when they're cold as well.
That's true.
If it's real cold out, they never go into closed loop. They're just reading off a table, so they could be just dumping all kinds of stuff into the sky.
Right.
Yeah.
My Disco never goes into closed loop anyway, so every time I start it, basically a baby seal dies somewhere. Oh well.
Thanks, Dave. All right, moving on to copycat. JLR has filed suit in China against the a Range Rover Evoque competitor or copy called the Lanwin X7, which we've talked about before in the podcast.
Haven't they tried suing before and been denied?
I don't think they sued before. It was just announced that they were coming out with a Lanwin.
Right, but there was some sort of claim, and the Chinese says, oh, no, there's no infringement there.
That's what I understand as well, that the Chinese have rejected... through their court system, have rejected the claim.
Yeah, I believe so.
Right. No, I think previously we discussed it previously. It was just more discussion. This time, JLR actually went to court, and so it sounds like I didn't see that about the government saying.
I thought I read that in the previous episode. When it first came out.
Yeah. Well, and apparently the other automakers were waiting to see what happened, including Ford, Volkswagen, Caddy, because there's other copycats.
Can't imagine that the Land Rover would be the only one to be copied.
Indeed.
And although this is
it,
just
it
sort of
hell of a compliment if it was.
Yeah. This is just sort of normal for China, as they don't have a traditional copyright system like we do. It's culturally, it's just different. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same concerns.
Right. Moving to Brazil, the Land Rover celebrated the opening of the Land Rover manufacturing plant in Brazil, and they had put that out on the Instagrams, and so the new plant is open in Brazil.
I wonder what the dress code is.
First of that plant come with a side of Zika?
Possibly. That said, they did actually do a very interesting art project related to the opening of it. They had an artist who sort of teamed up with employees and school children in the community to paint the center of the town. So that's pretty cool.
What I find interesting, or at least I'm curious about in the future, is are they going to start allowing the Brazilian division to produce their own variations of the product? You know, some of the coolest stuff Volkswagen ever made came out of Brazil, and you can only get it there.
And the other side of that is that Brazil produced, in the Volkswagen example, produced models far, far longer than any other country did, or most other countries. For example, I think they only just discontinued the van a year or two ago.
Right, right. And the Volkswagen Fox that was sold in the U.S. was out of Brazil.
Correct. That was a Brazilian model.
Go Brazil.
Yeah, they do some cool stuff down there. They like their cars. So it'd just be interesting to see what they can do with Land Rover if allowed.
All right, well, hope maybe once I get the Olympics
taken
care of.
They had a Synchro, because I might actually have to go to Brazil then. And bring back my side of Zika and a Synchro.
You know, Dave, your company has operations in Brazil. You can go down. You might be able to work for them.
Yeah, we do. We're kind of everywhere.
Can we get a diplomatic pouch sent back? Something about 110 inches long.
Yeah, that's right. So moving on in the news, a couple reviews from the States. 2016 Land Rover Range Rover Sport TD6 review. And this was Roadshow, which is a CNET publication. And they said they like the air suspension, delivers a comfortable ride, while the available diesel engine is a reasonably economical advanced off-road system. Let this SUV get far off the beaten path. Bad navigation system, destination entry requires digging through too many menus. The dynamic driving program is not available with a diesel engine. Oh, that's interesting. And bottom line, they said the TD6 makes an extraordinary, comfortable, capable SUV. While its diesel engine achieves a much better fuel economy than the gas-powered equivalent, but don't expect the most modern electronics or performance driving. So it's just they liked it. And yes, it's kind of support. Of course, you have to pay $93,000 U.S. For the privilege. And that's a supercharged V8 getting 60 miles to the gallon. There was another review, similar, and this one is from Automobile Magazine, and they had an HSE, Range Rover Sport TD6, and this one was actually cheaper. I believe it was something like $80,000, I think, was what they ended up spending. Yes, $84,000 is their as tested with a 3-liter turbo diesel. So there you go. So if you want to know what they're like to own one of those, feel free to read those articles. And someday we'll get him on as a guest. I forgot his last name.
Will Hedrick.
Will Hedrick.
Will Hedrick,
thank you.
Defender of Defenders.
Yes, he posted out on defendersource.com, we'll have a link, of course, in the show notes, about a Defender that was damaged by the U.S. government contractor when it was seized back in, I think, July 2014. The gentleman whose name is not mentioned here because he didn't want to be revealed was in the middle of a restoration. The Defender was in parts and pieces. There were good parts. There were bad parts. And when
it was actually pretty close to a reassembly, actually, as well.
And the contractor, in seizing the vehicle, you know, drug it across the ground. They threw all the parts together and they bound it together so it didn't fall off the truck. And pretty much destroyed it.
Yeah, what did they care? They figured it was going to the crusher anyway.
That's exactly what they said in the article. Was, hey, what do you care? It's going to the crusher.
Since the owner's never going to get it back, it's going to be crushed because that's what we do with these awful things.
Yep. And then they proceeded to leave it in that state in a field for the next majority of the year.
Yep.
Until it was returned.
In fact, he did get it back. So they're now Will is now trying to get some financial compensation from because of the how they treated the vehicle.
Well,
so
let's hope he prevails on that.
Well, one of the first time ever any vehicles have been returned from being seized. So
he's got a hell of a track record.
But
that.
Actually, it's not the first time, guys. This seizure of I'll use the term gray market in the old days has been going on for some time. What bothers me the most is that as of yet, there hasn't been a definitive case, including those of Will Hedrick, in which the federal action has been ruled, if you will, invalid. The methodology, the evidence presented, the procedures used, all of those have been the reasons that vehicles have been returned. And my sort of overall concern remains that as of now, unless it's a technicality, in other words, somebody goofed in not following their own stated procedures within Customs or Homeland Security or DOT or NHTSA, these vehicles, any vehicle, is still liable for confiscation in this manner. I only wish that at some point a case could be brought which could work its way up the court system, which actually asks the question of whether this is a valid activity within the authority of a federal government.
Right. We need some actual case law.
Yeah, I agree. You know, most of them end up in settling, which Will's, you know, with this seizure, he did settle. He did come up with some good arrangements in his settlement. Obviously, he got the vehicles returned and some compensation, but he also, which this particular case is an example of, he negotiated the ability for individuals to separately, you know, file claims for damage. So if he had not had the foresight to negotiate that, they would not even be able to do this.
Right.
And there's another case that he has pending and probably a few more. I think the next one in line after this is someone who had their wiring harness wrapped around the steering column.
It was wrapped around the prop shaft.
Prop shaft, yeah. Completely destroyed.
Well, I think Jeff hit the nail on the head about the there's no case law.
Right, because they keep settling out of court instead of going to court and actually setting a legal precedent. Right.
Well, that's because the government doesn't want there to be case law.
Of course not.
Because the whole thing could be undermined. This all goes to civil forfeiture, which even goes to drug cases even more so than the gray market material. So that all underlines this whole thing about it's property, it's not the individual. And that's, you know, like, hey, we can seize property even because the property didn't commit the crime. The person committed the crime. And so you can't.
Right. The property is not protected by the U.S. Constitution. Because the property is not a citizen.
Exactly. It's not a.
But it can be treated like a defendant. But guess what? That defendant gets to be guilty until proven innocent.
There you go. That's basically it comes down. And they don't want it to go to court.
And they don't want to go to court because that will establish a precedent for that to be changed.
And very possible.
So they've been carefully settling out of court to avoid that.
That's right. And then, but of course, ends up costing you money either way. But that's, yeah. So there we go. Wow, we actually had some real serious discussion there on law and whatnot. Woo. Or something close to it.
Law and whatnot, yes.
Law and whatnot.
A new series coming to NBC.
That's right. Chung chung. Law and whatnot. Chung chung.
And, you know, in this case, you know, the red tape is just sort of, I don't know how much is driving Will Hedrick nuts, but I think he said it took about 5 months to even get the correct name and contact information for the department in charge of the seizures to submit the claim.
No, it was the contractor.
It's just a nightmare.
It took him forever to find out who the actual contractor was that did the work, quote unquote.
Oh, was it the contractor?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, because again, it goes to why would anybody ever challenge them? Because your truck seized. Do you want to spend the money to get it back? Yeah.
And the bureaucracy is such that any one part of the government, even the smallest branch, has no idea what the other parts are doing, which, partially that was our original intention.
It's good. No. Yes and no.
What scares me is they don't seem to care that they don't know.
Exactly. Someday.
Maybe. Moving on. We talked about this gentleman before, Doug DeMorrow, and apparently he, on June 2nd, he published, I drove a six-wheeled drive Land Rover fire truck, which admittedly was pretty cool.
Yeah, I almost bought one once and I could kick myself for not doing it.
I'm gonna kick you right now. It was pretty cool.
I'm gonna kick you later.
All right, and I'll just line up. I had my chance at a Carmichael and I passed.
So this one was in Charleston, South Carolina, and Relic Imports apparently brought it in, but it was pretty cool. So you get a chance.
They are very cool.
Yeah, and yeah, it's slow as molasses, but man, it'd be just kick ass.
That's Heritage,
exactly. Right, I think that probably might be one of only two or three
they
in the continent.
They don't go fast.
So even though we kind of trashed Mr. DeMorrow last time, at least this month, was kind of cool.
Well, he likes to trash vehicles and vehicle owners too. So
I guess
it's
that's
fair.
That's a shtick, right?
Mm-hmm. Some people like to have nothing good to say.
Moving along in news, Norway moves closer to banning sales of gas-powered cars by 2025. Well, it's a little misleading. The headline, apparently what they're trying to do is have an agreement on a target of zero new fossil fuel cars sold from 2025 on. No outright ban, but strong action. Yeah, and so even though Norway is, I think, Europe's largest oil and gas producer, they may still want to go down that road, apparently.
Well, I guess if they're not using it, they can export more of it and make money.
There we go. Maybe. So just that's out there. Something to think about.
They want to be carbon neutral for the environment, I'm assuming, is their goal with that.
I didn't see that in the article, but it's very possible. I mean,
I would think that'd be the motivation.
Yeah, that makes some sense.
It's too bad, zero fossil fuel vehicles, that rules out diesels as well. I wonder how
their
battery technology is coming.
It does not rule out biodiesel.
Oh, that's true. Hmm.
Although, I think it was two Top Gears ago, they did test the new Tesla SUV.
Yeah, the Model X.
Oh, man, that thing was killer. That was just pretty damn cool.
I wonder what the battery life is like the Norwegian winter, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to know what the battery life is anywhere after about 10 years.
Oh, yeah. That's been discussed, yeah. I mean, that's out there.
For those of us who think a 10-year-old vehicle is too new to own, it's a good question to ask.
You guys must have struck it rich to have vehicles as new as 10 years old. I'm nowhere near that.
Well, actually, my good car is now 14 years old, Jeff, so I'm just rounding up to 10.
You have a 2011 Jetta Sport Wagon.
Yeah, I don't have possession of it. And it's a 2010.
A 2010. I'm lucky to have a well-paying job, Jeff. How's that?
Yes, you are.
Yes, so there you go.
And I'm happy for you.
Yeah, I'm happy for you, too.
Yes. Because guess where all my money goes?
Can you direct deposit your paychecks in my account?
I do, pretty much as it is.
All right.
This is nothing to do with Land Rovers in particular, just like the Norway article didn't. But there's I saw this, just happened to come across it on YouTube, called Engineering Explained. And the one that I particularly liked, it touched me, doesn't sound right, that I likened to.
Yeah, I need to be more than an arm's length from you when you say that.
Yes, exactly. It was driving stick, and the video is five things you should never do in a manual transmission vehicle. And it's 8 minutes, but I think it's well worth seeing. Don't rest your hand on the gear shift, because even a light touch will wear the
shift forks and synchros, all those things that aren't meant to have actual contact when the vehicle is running, that only used during a shift. If your hand is sitting on the knob, you're actually going to put a small load on them all the time, and it will prematurely wear them out.
And that would apply, of course, if you have a Land Rover that is a stick, then obviously the same things would apply.
Anything with a manual transmission.
Yeah. So that was, and you know, talking about
same as riding with your foot on the clutch.
Same deal. They talk about that too. Yeah, don't ride with a foot in the clutch. And so interesting. And I think there's some other ones that you may want to check out. I'll have a link to again to their YouTube page. But it's called Engineering Explained. And there's a bunch of other things in there. But why the rotary is dead. That's interesting. Double clutching. Don't coast in neutral. Five things you should never do in an automatic transmission.
Oh, and he's got a lot of other videos explaining, you know, how various functions of vehicles actually work as well. So for those who are trying to figure out how, you know, how four-wheel drive works, how center diffs work, how, all of that stuff, you know.
Horsepower versus torque, cat-back exhaust explained. Yeah, there's some really interesting videos, and they're not that long, and I think he does a good job at doing explanations too, and it's not too far over your head, and you know, it's not, and there's not a bunch of crap going on, and you know, I think it's worth your time.
Yep.
So I mentioned this at the beginning of the show about, we had a Twitter response. Sam Watson had tweeted and that he was in Egypt, and he has a Defender 110, and that he was and taking a picture on Instagram and put it on Twitter of him out in the desert, and I messaged him back and said, "Hey, nothing in front of a pyramid." So he came through. He actually went and got a picture of his Defender in front of a pyramid and sent that over to us. So you probably saw it on the Twitter account. If you didn't, I'll have a link in the show notes. You can check that out.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think we need to start a new series, but you have to back them up the steps in front of the monument to join the club.
Well, we would
and then be chased down by guards.
By guards.
Yeah, I think they frown upon that at this point.
Well, there's the story of what's his name?
Q
who went down to the
arch. The arch in St. Louis.
The St. Louis Arch and backed up his Series 1 up on the steps, and DHS and all the security comes out. "What are you doing here?" And they took him into custody. And yeah, I just wanted a picture.
And there's now T-shirts that are available from some T-shirt shop out west that memorializes the event.
Yep.
I'm bummed I can't find the picture online anymore.
Huh.
I'm sure it's out there somewhere. Yeah.
The internet's gotten bigger since then.
It has. So thanks, Sam Watson, for taking a picture in front of his Defender in front of the Saqqara Step Pyramid in Egypt.
So if any of our other listeners are near any seven wonders of the world, please get a picture.
Oh, I need to take mine down to Falling Water and get
a
picture.
Maybe win some crap.
Maybe. We'd have to have crap to win.
Well, I don't know. Crap can be gotten.
I'll find something.
We'll find some crap. We'll make some crap.
There we go. So that's the news. We'll be back in a few moments with the next segment. Welcome back to the 39th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. We've been doing this 39 times.
And we still don't get it right.
I just realized it's the 39th episode of the Center Steer Podcast.
Yeah,
wow.
One of these times we'll get it right.
Get what right? Oh, the podcast itself.
Yeah.
Well, in trying to get it right, we've welcomed back one of our regular guests, Jeff Aronson, who is editor of Rovers Magazine, and we thought we would get an update from Jeff on what's been going on with him in the Rovers Magazine world. But before we do that, I want to send a thank you to Jeff, because we ended up last month talking to the SCAR folks in the Texas Rovers folks who hold SCAR. The part of that was because Jeff had them in the magazine and they knew Jeff, and they ended up making it easier for us to talk to them. So thank you, Jeff, for helping to make that connection in the Rover community for us. And I think you're having in the upcoming magazine episode, you're going to have something on SCAR itself and maybe the Barber Toy Run.
Yes, and thank you. And I commend you for meeting up and spreading the folks from Texas Rovers to your podcast community. It's an amazing organization when you consider the size of the state and the chapter meetings that are held in places that are hundreds and hundreds of miles apart from each other. It's quite remarkable what they pull off. I had an interesting experience this year at SCAR, which is their big event, the South Central Area Rover Rally. And I want to say this is probably, what, their 15th or 16th? They probably told you exactly.
I thought it was 18 or 19, if I remember right.
It is. Okay, thank you. Yeah. This is an event that attracts well over 100 Land Rovers and easily 250 to 300 people for upwards of 5 days. And one of the most remarkable relationships that I see from this is the support they receive from a Dallas-based automotive dealership corporation, which happens to operate the three Land Rover franchises, two in Dallas area, one in Austin. And that family company actually makes it possible, and I apologize if they covered this, I didn't remember them saying it, but it actually makes it possible for them to rent a 1,000-plus acre off-road park for almost a week and to have it for Land Rovers only. In turn, when this set of dealerships operate their Wheels events, Texas Rovers members serve as marshals and spotters and instructors at times for new off-roaders. And that relationship has remained powerful since the first days of Texas Rovers in the early 1990s. So this family business, the Snell Motor Group, was one of the first Range Rover dealerships in 1987 in the country, one of the first 60 dealerships. And they actually helped foster the club in its early years by automatically giving every Range Rover purchaser and later Discovery purchaser a year's membership to Texas Rovers. Came with your new Land Rover product.
That's smart. That's pretty cool.
It was very cool. And the fact that years later, after Land Rover North America decided that there was just too much resistance from dealers about Wheels events, so that they dropped it as a requirement, this dealer network still runs them and organizes them and puts people in those brand new, expensive, very luxurious Range Rovers and LR4s in the Discovery Sports, the LR2s that are still out there, and puts them off-road. And they get quite a turnout. And again, their staffing is from Texas Rovers members. It's really great to see that relationship work so well over these decades.
That is good. And I want to thank them. They sent Laura sent me a T-shirt and some stickers, so a special shout-out to her for that.
Yeah, because you don't have enough stickers.
No, always need more stickers.
The other neat thing that was done, and I'm sure they talked about it, of course, was the Barbara Toy tribute run.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I don't know if there were participants. I don't remember hearing, other than from Laura, about the run itself, but you should know that the sight of 14, 15 women drivers with their significant others or husbands sitting beside them silently as they drove some very challenging trails. I think you'll enjoy the photos that we've selected to show off just how challenging the trails were. It was quite something to see, and it was an all women's endeavor. It was I rode with one at her request, but kept quiet until I was asked a question, and did not offer instruction unless I was asked. It's a big change from the normal setup we see at off-road events.
So the surprising part is not that the women are driving; it's that the men are being silent.
Yes, that is hugely. And the other surprising thing is, if you have driven enough off-roading with other guys, is that when the trail leader gave an instruction through hand signals, it was follow.
What?
Yes. I was stunned.
The real question, though, is how many trail leaders were giving instructions simultaneously that the women had to choose between?
That's true.
Because that's the problem I have at a lot of events. Is there's two or three experts telling you what you should be doing, and the trick is you choose the one you trust the most and block out the others.
Yeah. Very, very well put. And they're usually arguing with each other, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Barbara Toy tribute thing, that was, I think, really cool and a necessary thing that I hope gets pushed across the country. And so that's going to be in an upcoming episode of Rovers Magazine. Is that correct?
The next issue, I just saw the proofs today, and I think you're all going to love it.
Outstanding. Good deal.
Yeah, there was one other event that I wanted to just mention. Again, it's in the upcoming issue. It was back in April also, and that was the Sand Rover Rally in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Now, the magazine has covered it for the past 3 years now, and it has grown into an extraordinarily entertaining event, largely because of the participation of a very active Gulf Coast Land Rover Club. If you had even identified for me what they meant by Gulf Coast prior to my first trip to the Sand Rally, I would not have known. But there are enthusiasts from Alabama, from Georgia, from Florida, and off-road group. Now, there aren't many hills in any of those places until you get into like North Georgia or North Alabama. But the fun part is that they all love to find themselves in some sort of gumbo mud and to see what they can do to extract themselves from it.
Wow. Where in Florida again?
The organizer is a guy named Mike Ragsdale, who operates a sort of a chain Fort Walton Beach area about 60 miles east of Pensacola, maybe closer. So the nearest, it's in Florida's panhandle. The region of Fort Walton Beach is on a very small scenic waterfront road called 30-A, and thus the name of Mike's organization. It's one of those relatively unspoiled sections of Florida. So amidst some of the condo developments, there's still lots of wooden buildings, wooden restaurants, or wooden homes, some on stilts, some not. A really wonderful beach vibe. If you were ever a John McDonald mystery fan from his Travis McGee days, this is the Florida that he liked. And it's the one that I think secretly humorous like Dave Barry wishes were still around, as opposed to the one he writes about all the time. It's a fabulous part of the state. I got lucky and was able to link up with the folks at Adventure Motor Cars in Birmingham, Alabama, who restored North American Defenders. And they, I flew in there and I drove down with them in a fabulous Defender 110 soft top custom. It was really quite a treat to do. Just a glorious vehicle.
Will there be pictures of the 110 soft top?
Yes, there are.
Good. Because I
yeah, there will be.
Cool.
It turns out, John, that it was first built off a 90 frame and then swapped out for a 110 frame by East Coast Rover. And East Coast built it, sold it to somebody who in turn sold it off, and Adventure Motor Cars bought it. One of its more interesting aspects is that it's a two-door 110. 110 Tides is filled with, I believe it's a total of six jump seats, side seats, soft top, a beautiful XR, a top.
Well, I got to say, if I was doing a soft top 110, I would do it with a two-door as well. I think structurally it's a better way to go, but it'd be kind of cool. It'd be kind of cool to do one like that.
It was a very cool vehicle. Five-speed, it was just fabulous. What a great way to drive down. And the range of vehicles show, and let me explain, the Sand Rally takes morning, like a and sets up off usually in a state park in Florida, by, and then spends the afternoon in a sort of show gathering right by the beach. And this one, a fabulous collection of beautifully junkyard saved disco ones, on totally unrestored but running beautifully, right up to these customized Defenders. It was really quite a sight. I saw more lightweights than I've seen in a while, and a few series trucks. Josh Barnett from Southern Overland was there and brought up a beautiful Series 3109.
Well, good. We look forward to reading about that in the next issue of Rovers Magazine coming out very soon, right? That's going to be the summer edition. Is that the next one? Or is that the fall?
That's the summer edition, right?
Good, good.
Nope, summer edition.
To our listeners, you may notice that Jeff's connection isn't the best, and he is in an island in Vinyl Haven. I'm not sure how I'll edit all this, but I'll do my best to make Jeff sound good. But I'm also not going to try to cut out what, you know, if I don't have to. So just bear with us with the connection. We're lucky to have Jeff. And
I believe his internet packets are being placed into bottles and floated ashore this time.
So speaking of Maine, where you are, you know, I follow you on Facebook, and I saw that you yourself and your and QE1 was in a video shoot for the Maine Department of Transport, Maine Department of Tourism. Am I correct in that assumption?
You are, at least partially. Nobody asked for me. They asked for my Land Rover. And the interesting aspect of this to me was that the state of Maine worked advertising agency out of Wisconsin, which had several state accounts for other states as well, and offered the opportunity to have use of a new land that transports folks in the videos who ostensibly were on their first visit to Maine. Those producers and the ad agencies rejected the new Land Rovers. What they asked for was for the field producer here in Maine to find antique vehicles so that the people, the models who were indeed truly on their first ever trips to Maine, would have a more striking looking vehicle to drive.
A real Land Rover.
And to me, the amazing part was that when I was suggested that I send a photo of mine, it was chosen. The QE1 was chosen. Now, the problem for me is that I used my Land Rover every day for work, dirty work, often. So I was having to actually clean particularly the inside of the vehicle, as well as at least try and get the grunge and accumulated filth of a winter and spring off the car before it went on this video shoot.
But you make it less honest that way, Jeff.
Oh, trust me, there's still plenty of honesty showing through.
All righty.
This, you know, I got enough dirt off so that somebody in some L.L. Bean borrowed clothing wouldn't have to go to the dry cleaner right away. But that was about it. And they were quite adamant. They didn't want the vehicle to be polished up or anything like that. They wanted it to look used, which it comes that way. Now,
from the factory.
So when I arrived at the photo shoot, I discovered that unlike any other shoot that I've been asked to have the car participate in, while I was to drive it at times, they also wanted to videotape the models, the actors and actresses, if you will, driving the car. Now, I don't know how you guys have ever approached this. I know that, you know, you have to share the car with your spouses or significant others at times. But I had to actually let a stranger who only reluctantly admitted that he might know how to drive a standard drive my Land Rover.
Yeah, that would be painful.
If you're going to learn to drive a stick, that's the one to do it on.
Yeah, we actually started with low range.
It's really kind of hard to break stuff in low range on flat pavement. It's a great way to learn. I've taught many people, actually in my customers' trucks.
Now, the actor who was the driver, first off, fell in love with it. I believe he's a 28-year-old IT guy out of Richmond, Virginia.
He fits the profile.
Fell in love with it, but was amazed when he first tried to touch the brakes. And I explained that there aren't power brakes. He was amazed that the steering could be at once so heavy and so vague at the same time.
So clearly he's never been in a series truck before.
Right. And that the windows slid open.
Oh, boy.
Now, that being said, after 5 days in and out of the vehicle, he and his wife, as well as the other couples involved, there were three couples, were completely enamored of a Land Rover.
So you did your job well.
All I had to do was let them be with the car. The QE1 did all the hard work.
They sell themselves.
So what you're saying is that the next Land Rover event that we all go to in Maine is going to be much better looking.
No, because it'll be in the winter.
Yeah, Dave, just wait till they get into a series truck and drive all the way to Maine in February. Yeah, that'll go over well. They'll run away.
They won't even make it.
No.
Stay over 50 when they're in their 20s.
They'll be like, there's no heat? No, there's no heat.
I thought Jeff was just referring to the fact that they may be there, but they'll be wearing so many clothing you can't tell whether they look good or not.
They did.
Were you the only Land Rover there for part of the shoot?
Yeah, I did try and recruit some others because I thought they might, because I think they did want multiple vehicles so that in case mine broke down or something like that.
Really?
Because they had all this expensive talent and they had this expensive production team. There must have been 20 people involved, minimum.
Well, but the problem is finding available Land Rovers because they're all out there doing important things for important people.
Yes, and actually finding somebody else who had that much time. I was fortunate that I was able to work on the magazine while they were shooting these endless streams of videos. But the QE1, it will be in almost every one of them. The website of the state is called Visit Maine, M-A-I-N-E. And I believe that's a .com. Yes, visitmaine.com. And they just run endless series of videos of different parts of the Maine experience. And the idea behind this one, apparently, is you're visiting Maine for the first time. I'm told that the publication date online will be July 19th.
Oh, good. I'll have a link to Visit Maine in the show notes. And after July 19th, check it out and see if you can see Jeff's QE1, if you don't already know what it is. But
well, the other interesting experience came when we have one motel in this island, and the motel owner asked me if I would give him a list of the old vehicles on the island. He knew that I would know them, and I did. I included my own, so because I had no idea why I was asking. But G.H. Bass Shoe and Sportswear came to the island with another production crew and stayed here for 4 days doing catalog and online catalog shoots here. And again, wanted my vehicle for the whole 4 days. So the interesting part is not that it's my vehicle. That's good for my vanity, but that's it. It's the fact that I'm finding through the magazine how many other Land Rover owners are being asked for their series or defenders to be used in a wide variety of advertising or social media. It's something that I'm actually going to devote an article to for our holiday issue, because I'm really intrigued with all the comments I get from production supervisors, from directors, storyboard creators, marketing people from ad agencies. Why is it that they want that look for this enormous range of product and services? Why do they want to be affiliated with that?
Because it's cool, Jeff.
Oh, I know. I think I'm speaking to a choir that's going to say hallelujah right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But
well, I think the actual answer, though, is it's unique.
Yes, and I'm hoping that the compilation of other experiences from other Land Rover owners who are magazine subscribers will be a message to Land Rover about what that Defender look means to a much wider public than just its car buying public.
You know, my takeaway from this is that, you know, that they've done all these neat tourism videos with your particular example. And I'm just thinking this is a tremendous opportunity for someone who wants to have a fleet of vintage Land Rovers that they rent to tourists when they come. And you know, they see these videos and all the cool things they can do in an old Land Rover. Somebody needs to have them available for rental.
And, you know, there was a guy who tried that once up in the Bangor area. And one of the things he ran across was the very point, John, that you mentioned when you talked about the YouTube video series. It's how few people can drive a manual.
Yeah,
that can be taught.
Well, and that's generally an American problem.
Yes, but you know, it was interesting when I was in Iceland for the Discovery Sport launch with Land Rover and talked to the various Land Rover, the various companies that rent 4x4s, and it's largely Land Rover Defenders there. One of the problems they're having with their American customers is fewer and fewer can drive the standard 5-speeds, which is the way they outfit them. They hardly have any automatics.
But see, I just see that as part of the adventure. You show up, we'll show you how to drive it, we'll check you out, and we'll send you on your way.
Yes, oh, I agree. But of course, if you're the company owner, how many clutches do you want to replace?
Well, I personally don't, but I get where you're going.
Well,
I mean, I think that's
the American real problem. Not to pick that much more.
So I think what we really need here is for those people who can't drive a standard, an Uber-like service with only Land Rovers.
Oh, there you go. It comes with a driver.
Brilliant.
Actually, that is a good idea.
That is a good idea.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, but the only problem is if you get a series truck, the driver can only do about 4 hours before like they're beat up, but the customers will like, yeah, keep going. It's fun. I'm having a great time. And like, no, you're not driving this thing.
No. Any long-term series owner is by now hardened in the saddle that way.
Yes, that's right.
No, I would agree with that.
Indeed.
The problem really lies with the passenger. Because,
right.
For example, if you're in a place like Maine or somewhere like Vermont and say you ran a service like that and let people, you know, fly into the airport, you pick them up, you drive them down to the ski mountain, it's going to be an hour from the airport, 2 hours from the airport. That's a long ride in a series vehicle for a passenger who is not expecting it. They may see the photos in the brochure and think it looks awesome.
Let's face it, the only one, the people could afford that, they're going to want to be in a Range Rover.
Exactly.
I'd put them in the back in jump seats and give them a bottle of whiskey.
That would help. Morgan, I would recommend Mad River Distillery to them.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Very tasty. Mm.
So what else is going on in your world, Jeff? What else is coming up in the magazine?
Well, we're going to have a coverage of an absolutely fabulous event to me that keys on to our discussion of the Barbara Toy tribute run. You've probably saw in the magazine our coverage of the Rally des Gazelles in Morocco.
Yes.
Which is hundreds of teams from around the world competing in largely 4x4s, Land Rovers among them, off-road orienteering more than off-road racing. And it's all women's teams. Well, one of the founders for the American operation of getting American teams involved is the pro rally driver, Emily Miller, who trained with and drove for Rod Hall off-road and for Pro Rally Series. So Emily Miller is behind an American version of the Rally des Gazelles called the Rebel Rally. It's going to be held on public lands starting around the Lake Tahoe area and winding up in the San Diego area at the end of what I believe is a 7-day event. Off-road only, orienteering, no GPS, compass, maps, parallel rules, paper maps at that only. And you are required to find checkpoints on your own. The path that you take is yours to determine. You have a base camp every night. There's some time sections to push the competition harder. They are limiting it to 60 teams. I was on a conference call, a press call the other night. They already have 45 teams, and this is for October. And they should probably have no problem picking up the full 60 teams with entry fees already paid and so on. It is a remarkably well-organized event. Rebel is spelled R, that's R in American, but R in New England, E-B-E-L-L-E, rally.com.
As in Belle, as in the female.
Yes, Rebel. Exactly. Yeah. Take off on the French. I'm very excited that this event is happening in this country. It opens up quite an opportunity for people who kind of understandably can't afford to go all the way to Morocco and have their vehicle shipped over or rent a vehicle over there. But I think this thing's going to grow, and to listen to Emily Miller detail the organization she's created, the people that are working with her, is just so impressive. Extraordinary individual. And look forward to coverage of that when the event is held and run. There are a few Land Rover teams running.
And I guess anybody from around the world is able to join? Is that?
Yes. They have a few foreign entries, but most of them are American. And frankly, a lot of them are fairly local to the Southwestern California Pacific Coast.
That's really cool. That's actually a really cool thing. Yeah. Are you going to you get to go, or are you going to be at the finish line or something?
You know, shamelessly, I am pushing for that. So far, nobody has invited me. So far that, but I'm hoping that that might happen. Regardless, their press cooperation is terrific, and I'm confident we'll get a great story for it. Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent.
Indeed.
That is really cool, especially following on the Barbara Toy,
It's very exciting. Because it opens up a whole new group of people who have always participated in events, but simply haven't moved over to that driver's seat. And to me, to think of what that could do in terms of the numbers that can appear on off-road events now is very encouraging.
Absolutely. How long is that expected to take, by the way? Is it a, you think it's roughly a week event?
I believe it's a week. I believe it's a week between arriving, having a tech session, and the final day and sort of gala at night. Yep. I think it's 7 days.
Very cool.
And otherwise, the QE1 continues to rack up mileage, towing a ridiculous amount of gear, some which gets used, some which doesn't, every day at work around this island. And it just does great things.
It's doing important things.
It's doing, I believe they're very important, yes.
For important people. Somewhere.
But also, I am finding, again, this almost renewed interest in series vehicles, not necessarily restored within an inch of their life or not necessarily used as collectors, but for the, just the sheer joy of that vintage driving experience on-road and off-road. I'm amazed at how many I see that are perfectly good running vehicles. They're just, they haven't been polished up. They're keeping their patina. I just think it's wonderful.
I had an interesting experience in my Series 3 this past week or so. I was in the left lane at a traffic light waiting to turn to go get fuel. And so I had the red light for the left turn and the green light for the folks traveling in the westbound lanes, in American on the right side, they had a green light. All of a sudden, I look over, and a gentleman had stopped his car, put his flashers on, and stopped and goes, "Hey, what is that?" And I was like, and he stopped, and there wasn't a lot of traffic, but he stopped. And I could see his flashers on. I go, "Oh, it's a Land Rover. What year? 1980. Thanks, great truck." And took off. That was a new one.
That's very good.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you for joining us as our guest this month on the podcast and give us an update on what's going on in your world and what's coming up in the magazine.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, John and Dave and Morgan. It's always a delight to be on the show. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to hear from the Land Rover community as a whole. Thank you.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. And go out to, and I have it in the show notes, of course, but go out to roversmagazine.com and you can look at all past editions. Is that the right website? Did I have it right?
That is it. You have it pegged perfectly. Good and job. Once the new edition is in the mail to subscribers, we upload that one as well.
And the magazine is free, so if at least to the United States, right? I assume if you're outside the country, do you guys charge for that?
We do not send outside of North America.
There you go. So if you're within North America, you can get the magazine for free and read Jeff's articles and of what the things we just discussed.
And we can see the videos at visitmaine.com. Is that correct?
And go to visit.
That is correct.
Are those going to be broadcast on television as well or just the website?
You know, they don't do a lot of television. I mean, they'd be ready for TV if that's what they want, but they're longer form. And they apparently have found the website to be so productive for the state that it is their preferred medium right now.
Nice.
Yeah, you don't get a per click for that, I guess, huh?
No, the QE1 might, but it won't disclose to me its agreements with the Maine Department of Tourism.
keeping it from you.
It's keeping it from me, and it's keeping me at a distance for that. I have other duties for it, and it just isn't sharing right now.
Yeah, smart old girl.
And you also have a Corvair, right?
I have a 1966 Corvair, indeed, kind of a rat rod that I use often when I have to go to the mainland because it is a brilliant highway car, and if it can't get on the ferry to come home, I can leave it in a parking lot, and my Land Rover is still here for my work. But it is a wondrous rear-engine, air-cooled, fine-handling sport coupe. And I also have a 1980 Triumph Spitfire. I have the last of the Triumph Spitfires.
That's right. I forgot about the Triumph you had. Yeah, nice.
And I love them all. That's my new one, the 80.
Okay.
That's the 1500 in that, right?
Yes. Okay. It's thoroughly emasculated by lowered compression and some emission stuff in order to try and meet the last gasp of emission standards with that engine.
Gasp is about right.
And that is about the term.
But what a fun little car it is, I have to tell you.
Now, you need to come down, Jeff, to Pittsburgh in the middle of July for the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix.
Oh, John, I would so love to do that. I've talked to Dave LaChance of Hemming Sport and Exotic because they cover it. He's gone, and it's just, I think it's a fabulous event. It is. So envy you guys for having that.
And of course we'll be there this year. And in fact, on Sunday, I'm taking the 109 into the road rally that they have, which is a timed event. And, that's, I think this is the third time I'll be participating in the road rally with the 109. They have a bunch of things that go on through all of July. It's pretty cool. Very, very cool.
But
if you come down, you got a place to stay.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Yeah, we're just 17 miles from the site, and there you go. It's a neat event. It's just really interesting.
In addition to the race, there's of course the show on the Saturday, the second weekend, the British Car Day.
Right, and that's what. Yeah, there's a ton of triumphs there. That's the reason I thought it's
hosted by the Triumph Club, Western Pennsylvania Triumph Association. So you'd know there'd be a couple triumphs here.
That's right.
Well, if Jeff comes down, I will roll out my disco, literally roll it sideways down a hill and onto the golf course for the British Car Day.
Yeah. Good.
Perfect, David. Perfect.
Good. Well, thanks again, Jeff, for joining us on the podcast, and we'll hopefully have you back in a couple months to give us further updates on your adventures.
I would love to. Thanks for the opportunity, guys. Take care.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast for June 2016. This is the 39th edition, as I had mentioned before. We are returning to our Heritage segment, and the last time we discussed Heritage, we started on the Range Rover. And this time, Morgan's going to take us through the chassis and the suspension.
Thank you very much for having me back. As discussed in my initial overview of the Range Rover, which we now refer to as the Range Rover Classic, Spencer King and the Rover Company set out to create a capable off-road vehicle that was as comfortable as a saloon car. They successfully launched such a vehicle with the Range Rover in 1970. So, as you mentioned, we'll dive into the backbone that makes that possible, the chassis and suspension. Rover maintained the box section ladder frame design for the chassis for the Range Rover, though it's not as simple and flat a design as that which was used for the series Land Rovers. But this design provides a very strong structure to attach the suspension, drivetrain, and body to, which resists twisting like the popular C-channel frames do. And this also helps maintain a lower sprung center of gravity. The chassis was initially introduced with a 100-inch wheelbase. You may recall that the project to develop the Range Rover was named the 100-inch station wagon, though they eventually introduced a longer 108-inch wheelbase chassis in 1992 for their higher-end models. This enabled them to provide more legroom for rear seat passengers in the LSE and County LWB or long wheelbase models, and those were the names in the UK and US respectively. Though the Range Rover initially shipped with no power steering, it was added as an add-on option in 1973, just a few years after introduction. It did take nearly a decade for it to become a standard feature, though, which it did in 1979. While the chassis is evolved from the series Land Rover, the eventual addition of power steering made for easier maneuvering what really set the Range Rover apart from the series Land Rover, aside from the motor and gearbox, which we'll get into at a later date, in terms of on and off-road comfort and performance, was the suspension. It was inspired by the comfort of the coil sprung suspension of the Rover P3, as well as a Ford Bronco, which was purchased for research. Rover quickly decided that coil sprung instead of leaf sprung was the way to go. Series Land Rovers used strong but stiff leaf springs on all four corners, and some off-road vehicles at the time were starting to use coil springs in the front while retaining stronger leaf springs in the rear for increased cargo capacity. Fitting the Range Rover with four soft, long-travel coil springs allowed for a very comfortable ride, much greater articulation, and even better traction over varying terrain. The Range Rover's coil springs were about half as stiff as most coil springs. So it was about 150 pound per inch, while most are rated around 300 pound per inch. So that reduces traction loss with limiting the amount, by limiting the amount of ground pressure lost during wheel droop. This improves traction. It also reduces cargo load capacity due to the soft nature of the springs. Fortunately, the rover engineers came up with a solution which not only allows for high cargo load capacity, which is about 1,500 pounds with two occupants, as well as leaving the leveling the vehicle. So they came up with a self-leveling strut attached to an A-frame link connected to the rear axle and to the chassis. This levels the vehicle cargo load front to back and assists the rear springs. Unfortunately, it did turn out that this self-leveling strut tends to wear relatively quickly, causing more reliance on the softer springs and results in sagging. But overall, it's a pretty ingenious solution to the problem. These big advances in suspension gave the Range Rover some of the best ramp travel index, which is a measure of articulation. So some of the best ramp travel index scores in stock vehicles, really only to be bested by the more modern Range Rover models, though the modern Jeep Rubicon and the like are getting pretty comparable, especially with their electronic stabilizer disconnects.
Yeah, and it only took them 45 years to come up with that.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of stabilizer bars, also known as sway bars or anti-roll bars, the Range Rover did not originally have them, as they limit articulation and tighten up the suspension a bit. Being a taller vehicle with a higher center of gravity and soft springs, they had a fair amount of body roll. They were still pretty stable, but it was something that the driver and passengers really needed to get accustomed to and be comfortable with. That said, when speeds were increased in 1984 due to the addition of fuel injection, radius arm bushings were stiffened up and progressive rate rear springs were utilized to reduce those body roll effects, since you could achieve higher speeds. Then in 1991, these changes actually were reverted back to the softer bushings and linear rear springs when they actually added sway bars. These were actually not the last of the suspension improvements, definitely not by a long shot. In late 1992, the high-end Range Rover received another pretty revolutionary suspension leap in the form of electronic air suspension, also called EAS. Dunlop engineered new long travel air springs for use in the Range Rover, which were automatically controlled by an ECU unit, an electronic control unit, as well as manually using an up-down rocker switch on the dash, plus an inhibit button to prevent automatic management in some situations. In this suspension system, air is drawn into and exhausted out from a 10-liter central tank through a dryer and compressor, and then height sensors on each wheel report to the ECU, which then controls the amount of air sent to each individual air spring via a solenoid valve block. So this provided automatic load leveling as previously provided by that auto load leveling strut. And it also added the ability to control the ride height on the fly. There are five height settings available, again, automatically or using the aforementioned dashboard controls. There was an access mode, which reduced stationary ride height by 2.5 inches below standard, to allow for easier loading and unloading of passengers and cargo. There's also a low profile reduced highway speed ride height by about 0.7 inches below the standard ride height that provided better aerodynamics and stability at high speeds. There was obviously the standard ride height, which was for normal just around town driving. There's a high profile rate, which raised height by 1.4 inches for off-road use. And then there's actually an extended profile, which would automatically be enabled if the ECU detected the vehicle was high centered. And that one would raise the height by 2.8 inches.
And that was one mode that was not selectable by the dashboard switch.
Exactly. So that's sort of the downside, but you know, at least it was there for emergencies. As long as it detected the emergency.
Yeah, so how would it know that it was high centered?
Well, the wheel sensors can tell how much pressure is on each wheel.
Oh, and how much travel's in them and all
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
If one is fully drooped and it's also spinning, chances are it's hung up.
Yep. In addition to the ride height modes, it would automatically adjust heights if a wheel lost traction. So just like you were mentioning, in addition to the other benefits of the air suspension, air springs are actually naturally progressive, so they don't bottom out as badly when hitting a large bump at speed like a coil spring does. And this is due to the way air compresses within the airbag. This new electronic air suspension system provided significantly better on and off-road performance, with the benefit of not having to tune the suspension for one single use case. But it's also prone to failure, puncture of airbags, air leaks, compressor failures, ECU issues. And unfortunately, all of these are expensive to repair, especially at this point. The common workaround for this is to replace the air suspension with coil spring conversions to improve reliability, though it doesn't really provide the load leveling functionality that the normal coil sprung Range Rover Classic models had, though generally they are not as soft springs as those original ones were. And there are a couple upgrade options. I'll go over them very briefly. For the coil sprung Range Rovers, if you're going for better on-road performance, and this is one of the reasons why the air suspension being able to tune itself on the fly is a better advantage. So if you are going for better on-road performance, you can go for uprated shocks to tighten up the handling. You can go with poly bushings. You can go with aftermarket sway bar kits if yours did not have sway bars, or if you want stiffer sway bars. There are the conversion kits to add them to the pre-1991 models. If you're going for better off-road performance, there are various aftermarket lifts to fit larger tires. Generally, lifts under 2 inches do not affect steering and driveline angles too much, so you don't have to do any really crazy additional engineering. If you go over 2 inches, pretty much going to run into that. You can also perform lifts using genuine Land Rover parts. A common upgrade is to use the Range Rover Classic rear springs on the front end, and then Discovery rear springs in the rear. For those carrying heavier loads but sort of want genuine, somewhat stock suspension, you can get genuine rear springs that were intended for the UK police models, and those are a progressive spring in the rear. You can do some spring and axle spacers, which allow small lifts. You can get sway bar disconnects so that you can, when you're off-road, disconnect your sway bar to allow for more articulation. Obviously, those should be reconnected for on-road use. In terms of the EAS system, the electronic air suspension, as I mentioned, often people end up replacing them with coil conversions. Those are generally a stiffer coil than the earlier ones. There are various other hacks you can do. Can install body lifts. Those are somewhat common in Australia. You can do air system bypasses, so basically allowing you to pump up your air suspension if the ECU were to fail or offline. There's a few things like that that you can do. And then in terms of the chassis itself, there are, I think there's one company that produces galvanized chassis, and I think that is, if I can find my notes here, I think Design a Chassis is the only one. Marsland and Richards don't seem to produce the galvanized chassis for the Range Rover Classic.
Interesting. Isn't Design a Chassis the one that used to make the coil sprung series truck chassis?
Yeah, yes. And I think they still do. But yeah, they're the only one so far that I've found that makes galvanized chassis.
There's a police version Range Rover. Is it anything more special than a regular Range Rover?
For the police model, no, there's not too much that's specific beyond suspension for just carrying heavier loads, because generally they just have more equipment that they're carrying. Range Rover, they did actually have a lot of conversion companies and kits. So very similar to the series Land Rover, where you see fire engines, ambulances, all of that. There are those for the Range Rover as well.
It's got cop motor, cop shocks, cop springs, and it goes great on.
Exactly.
That's, well, it's just, you know, in the United States, when you hear a police version, that usually means something special.
I'm just thinking Elwood Blues. But
I knew you were.
Yeah. That's all I think about either. Aside from suspension, I think they were relatively stock otherwise.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I think that covers sort of chassis, steering, and suspension. There's not a whole lot to steering, but the suspension went through quite a few, you know, revisions, and the Range Rover sort of stayed ahead in many respects there compared to other competition in the 4x4 market.
It was always power steering?
No, it was initially not power steering. It was an option for like 6 or 7 of the first 10 years.
I can't imagine that existing as an option for long. You'd think that would be pretty much standard for a luxury vehicle.
It wasn't a luxury vehicle when it first started.
True.
Well, it was, let's say not luxury, but upscale, not just a basic utility vehicle.
Right. Well, but the first two-door Range Rovers were. They were simply, they were much more refined than a standard Land Rover, but you washed out the interior. Back was all a rubber mat. It was steel. I think it was an option because they needed to price it accordingly. And just like they did with the first series Land Rovers, where windshield wipers were options, you had a base price that looked relatively doable.
See, now I understand that option because the windshield wipers don't do much anyway.
Right, they don't. They do go back and forth.
Yeah, they're driver entertainment more than anything else.
Entertainment or frustration and obstruction.
Yeah. But you raise, I think you make a good point, though, Jeff, that, it was not necessarily, it was a utilitarian vehicle, at least for the first, 5, 6, 8 years, I think, and it makes some sense.
Well, I think it was always intended to be, a bit upscale, but then
right.
they went quite upscale from there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right, and the Range Rover has a long history of various upscale models that were available. They have so many various special editions that were produced over the years.
Just how many came with whiskey? That's all Harold wants to know.
Probably only a couple, unfortunately.
the continuous supply of whiskey?
Well, that's an important thing to know.
And indeed it is. So what's next time on the Range Rover Heritage Cavalcade?
You know, once you have a chassis and suspension, you probably want wheels, brakes, axles, and differentials and stuff like that.
That's a lot of things.
It is.
I guess we'll find out on the next exciting episode of Heritage. That brings a close the 39th edition of the Center Steer podcast for the month of June. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I want to thank you for listening. Please visit our website for past shows and show notes. Also, connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Give us some feedback on news and topics we covered. I know Jeff's audio was not the greatest coming over the transom from the island that is Vinyl Haven. No need to let me know about it. I'm aware of it. We do have listeners from around the world, and we are happy to hear from you. So as Sam did from Egypt, send us a picture of your Land Rover in its native environment or some interesting place, maybe in front of a monument of some sort.
Or simply just a picture of it doing something important somewhere for someone.
And don't forget to visit the 4x4 Radio Network to listen to the other shows that are part of the network. And you can listen right on the website to the other shows. If you are a sponsor and you're interested in sponsoring a podcast, send me an email. Always looking for folks, wonderful individuals or companies that wish to sponsor what we're doing here for ourselves. I want to thank Jeff from the island, as you know, Vinyl Haven. I like saying Vinyl Haven, for joining us on the show today. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
And your connection cleaned up greatly, which is wonderful. And I'm sorry, the next edition of Rovers is due in the mail.
Ed, you will see it near the end of July. It goes out in the mail near the end of July.
Sweet.
And is John receiving more additions to his tea set?
I did receive one, and I didn't mean to. I sent him, I just said, I told him on Facebook, and this was not an official sighting, but he still sent me a mug. It was for the beer that the Range Rover, well, it's not really a Range Rover beer, but it was a beer can, had a Range Rover on it.
Yes. John continues to, if you will, milk the system. And
It's duly noted, but we play by the rules, and as long as John continues to manipulate the rules that way and stays within the boundaries, he will continue to add to his crockery collection.
Yeah, he's running out of cabinet space here at his house.
Indeed, I am.
Well, you would think he would share them with his friends, wouldn't you?
No, we know John.
Did they do a sighting? I don't think so. Come on. And joining us from the Green Mountain State, Mr. Heritage himself, Morgan.
Thank you very much.
And don't forget, Morgan has seriesparts.com, and you can check that out for all your series and Defender parts needs all around the world, right?
Although now that you're doing the Heritage segment on Range Rovers, I think you need to expand your offerings on your website.
There may have been a domain name purchase related to Range Rover Classic parts.
Ooh, and you heard it here first.
Exclusive content on the podcast. And all the way from Washington County in wonderful Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Dave.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us, Dave. I hope you were able to interject as you needed to.
Oh, I think I said a bit.
Well, I know your connection is about as good as Jeff's is, even though you're not far from Pittsburgh, but it seems not to be the best, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm pretty much in deliverance country. That's okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hear banjos when I drive to your house.
He is close to the Mason-Dixon line. Yeah, it's not that far away.
I'm just that much closer to Great Wheeling, that's all.
So until next month when we do this again for the 40th edition of the Center Steer podcast, I ask you to share the show with another fellow Land Rover owner or fan and ask them to listen to the show. Make sure you wave as you pass by. That includes you Range Rover owners.
And it's largely, you know, a little bit of mild off-roading, and it's cooking and whiskey. And nobody wanted to go.